What happens when the stories we tell ourselves about life become more real than life itself? Emma Bovary spent her youth hidden behind convent pillars, devouring contraband romances about tragic queens and passionate heroines. She memorized every moonlit balcony, every Venetian gondolier, every exotic landscape from illustrated magazines. By 15, she had constructed an entire architecture of longing, a blueprint for a life that could never exist in the muddy Norman countryside where she would spend her days. When Gustave Flaubert published her story in 1857, he was prosecuted for offending public morality. The scandal only confirmed what readers instinctively understood. This wasn't just a tale of adultery. It was a mirror held up to our most dangerous illusions, showing how the gap between fantasy and reality can swallow a person whole. Yonville L'Abbaye divides neatly between grazing land and plow fields, with identical shuttered houses and a church spire that dominates everything, a constant reminder of moral obligations. This setting presses down on Emma with the weight of convention. Her marriage to Charles, the country doctor, promised escape from her father's farm, but delivered only a different cage. Charles delights in small pleasures, evening meals, routine visits, morning intimacies. What might have been happiness becomes torture for Emma, who yearns for the passionate existence she's read about in novels. The town's inhabitants embody mediocrity. Homé, the pharmacist, spouts pseudo-scientific terminology while bullying his apprentice. The priest, Bornesian, offers platitudes instead of spiritual guidance, completely misunderstanding Emma's crisis. Even her lovers disappoint. Leon grows conventional in his legal career, while Rodolphe treats seduction as a mastered game. Emma's convent education prepared her only for romantic fantasies, teaching her to dream of love but nothing of financial management or autonomy. When her daughter Berthe eventually ends up working in a cotton mill, the cycle of limited opportunities continues. What transforms this provincial tale into literature is Flaubert's revolutionary approach to seeing. His description of Charles's cap, ovoid in shape with three circular sausage-shaped layers, makes a simple object strange and significant, simultaneously mundane and symbolic of Charles's mediocrity. Even wedding guests' attire becomes musical exposition, with dress coats, frock coats, and jackets subjected to elaborate variation. A farmer's ill-fitting suit speaks to social aspiration. A bourgeois gentleman's perfectly pressed coat suggests rigid conformity. Flaubert spent 5 years writing Madame Bovary, often lamenting his slovenly previous work. He would spend entire weeks crafting single paragraphs, reading them aloud in his famous gueuloir, shouting room, to test their rhythm. His letters revealed the painstaking labor, entire afternoons perfecting a single sentence. This obsession with finding le mot juste, the exact right word, marks a dramatic departure from his earlier works, establishing a new standard for literary realism where the ordinary world becomes extraordinary through the intensity of observation itself. Flaubert's revolutionary, free, indirect style captures Emma's consciousness directly. When she contemplates suicide at her window, we experience her vertigo firsthand. The ground seemed to sway beneath her feet as she stood at the edge, surrounded by vast space, the buzzing lathe like an angry voice summoning her. This technique lets us inhabit Emma's perspective without endorsing her choices, anticipating modernist literature. Emma's tragedy stems from confusing genuine feeling with romantic cliché. After the ball at La Vaubyessard, she traces Parisian routes on maps, memorizing fashion plates for elaborate toilettes she'll never wear. When Rodolphe abandons her, she addresses God with the same caressing words once murmured to her lover. Each passion, religious devotion, motherhood, adultery, disappoints when reality fails to match fantasy. Yet Flaubert doesn't merely mock her romanticism. Her yearning for something beyond provincial mediocrity reflects his own artistic sensibility. As he famously declared, "Madame Bovary, c'est moi." Emma's downfall follows escalating consumption, mirroring her emotional appetites. The merchant, Lheureux, his name suggesting both the happy one and the usurer, systematically entangles her in credit and promissory notes. As her affairs progress, spending accelerates. For Rodolphe, a riding habit, embroidered slippers, a silver-topped riding crop. For Leon, yellow curtains and carpet plans. Each purchase constructs a more romantic identity. Flaubert's detailed accounting reveals his understanding of 19th-century consumer capitalism. Promissory notes for 250 francs each, total obligations of 8,000 francs, the precise remainder after Charles sells everything, 12 francs, 75 centimes. This precision contrasts sharply with Emma's financial ignorance and magical thinking about money. The pre-sale inventory poignantly catalogs her dream's material remnants: a dress with a gold-braided collar, a cashmere shawl, a beaver muff, and four novels bound in gilt-edged Morocco. These objects, once symbols of refinement and escape, become mere liquidation items. Emma's body itself becomes commodity when she attempts trading sexual favors for financial salvation, approaching the notary Guaman and then Rodolphe. Poison serves as both Emma's literal death and the novel's central metaphor. She's been poisoned since her convent days by romantic novels that created impossible expectations. The pharmacy becomes symbolically charged. Homais's red and green jars casting colored light, fetuses floating in murky alcohol. Flaubert's medical training surfaces in his clinical rendering of Emma's arsenic poisoning: blue-tinged face, dripping sweat, chattering teeth, violent convulsions, following actual symptoms with horrifying precision. The priest administers last rites, anointing her eyes, which had so fiercely craved every earthly luxury, her pleasure-seeking nostrils, her lying mouth, her sensation-hungry hands, and her feet, once so swift in speeding her to satisfy her desire. This methodical cataloging transforms religious ritual into a final accounting of Emma's sensual existence. As she kisses the crucifix passionately, a blind beggar's song drifts up from below, his grotesque appearance and lewd song about a young girl's love, creating ironic counterpoint to Emma's romantic illusions. After death, Charles insists on burying her in her wedding dress with white shoes and wreath, demanding three coffins and green velvet covering, a grotesque parody of romantic imagery. Charles discovers Emma's affairs but cannot condemn her, concluding everyone must have adored her. Meeting Rodolphe in a market, they share a beer as Charles gazes at this face Emma once loved. His phrase, "fate is to blame," captures his inability to judge her. The next day, he's found dead in the garden arbor, clutching a lock of black hair, died of grief. Everything is sold, leaving 12 francs to send Berthe to her grandmother, who dies that year. Berthe ends up in a cotton mill. Emma's romantic rebellion changed nothing. Her lovers move on unscathed. The novel's final irony? Homais prospers, awarded the Legion of Honor. Mediocrity triumphs, while passion leads to destruction. Yet Emma achieves immortality through Flaubert's art. Her yearnings resonate across cultures and centuries. We remember her watching fish vendors' carts disappear along distant highways, her face illuminated by firelight, her blue-tinged face in death. Her story warns that the stories we consume can consume us, but also reminds us that hunger for something more than ordinary existence, however dangerous, reflects something profoundly human. The question isn't whether we dream, but whether we can live with the distance between dreams and reality.